upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
I'm Janelle.
We're back again. Made it through 6 years. What's another episode?
I think it's six, where I was like, I thought you said not six more, Vicky. No.
What's one more episode?
She put a term limit on our relationship.
Listen, if it's not working, no, I'm kidding.
We might just run out of crimes. You never know.
We will never run out of crimes. Literally. I mean, that's a beautiful thing, kind of.
I mean it's that's not a horrible
I don't
want
to. Yeah, no, I take that back. I don't want to praise any of this. But, like, we'll never be out of a job.
Exactly, right? Well, just like a mortician.
Hobby. We'll never be out of a hobby.
Never be out of a job. People be dying.
Speaking of morticians.
Did I accidentally segue?
Yeah, kind of. If this is your first show listening, a special hello to you.
Hello.
But let's head over to the newsroom.
How do we get there?
Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
So this week, we're in the state of Maryland. This comes from the Baltimore Banner. Maryland is having some problems, y'all.
Have you been there?
No. But I most recently, Dr. Donald W. Alves, who is the medical director for the Maryland State Police.
Okay. Some gymnastics there in my brain for a minute.
is being accused of basically I'm trying to decide how to word this. He was associated with an erectile dysfunction clinic in a way that's not great. So at first, he denied that he had any connection to this clinic, but then he later said that he had this business relationship with this clinic that was, according to the article, run by a convicted felon and repeat securities fraud violator. And customers had complained was providing poor treatment and charging steep fees.
It's just dick pills. How hard is it?
Not dick pills. Da-dunch. Injections.
Dick injections.
Yeah. Yeah. He essentially was like allowing this clinic to use his name as one of their top doctors. And the other thing was he gave like authorization for physician's assistants to perform injections on the patients in his name.
I mean, that's I don't know how it works in Maryland, but that's not that uncommon in some areas to have physician's assistants doing some of the like prep preliminary.
Maybe it wasn't
stuff.
Physician's assistants. It was somebody who's not supposed to be doing it. Hold on, let me find
the receptionist.
Says the Board of Physicians received 3 complaints about the clinic between September 2020 and January 2021. They said they had been seen not by a doctor, but by non-physician staff. And then
the receptionist.
Yeah. And the non-physician staff had administered an injection into his penis. And that another customer said their insurance company called the clinic a scam company.
Yeah.
And the Dr. Alves originally told the medical board that he didn't know this clinic, wasn't sure why they were using his name. And then later he said he had been hired on to work a couple of days a month. And then later said that he had an agreement for the physician's assistant to treat the clinic's clients, calling for the assistants to give the clients injections without seeking permission from Alves.
That's the problem.
So it's interesting because this article is like, he resigned, I should also say, from the state police. But The article points out that Maryland has actually been in a lot of police controversy at the moment. Mm-hmm. Said they are talking about the quota system that they have within the state. They are talking about arresting a Western Maryland drug task officer for tipping off a wiretap target in exchange for money. Mm-hmm. They're talking about racial discrimination, overdose, death in jail. I mean, it's like, what's going on, Maryland?
Not just crabs.
And also, the state medical examiner is shilling dick
low
injections.
Low-key dick injections.
Pretty much. So that's the news.
All right. Don't go to Maryland. Get your crabs somewhere else.
Moving on to Netflix and Kill, which this week is a Hulu and Kill. Because we are talking about
a Hulu done it, if you will.
A Hulu done it. Oh, I like that. Ooh, that's good. We're going to have to start using that.
Yeah.
Stolen Youth.
Ah.
Inside the Cult at Sarah Lawrence.
This made me...
It was a lot.
Very upset.
Yeah. It's only about 3 episodes, I think. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot. Like, yes. Heavy. Mm-hmm. So... Essentially, what happens is this man named Larry Ray, mm-hmm. moves into this house that his daughter is staying at with a bunch of other sophomores attending.
On campus,
attending Sarah Lawrence College. And sort of like... starts influencing them in this weird sort of self-help way, kind mm-hmm. of. But then they all end up moving into this apartment with him where they have a very regimented schedule. And he was having sex with one of the college students.
At that time.
And later, yeah, I mean, it's so weird. It is so weird.
Just like when you watch it and you look at that man, you're just like, fucking how? If a guy like that walked up to me on the street and started talking to me, I'm like, fuck off.
Yeah.
He just has big fuck off energy about him.
There's a lot of mental manipulation mm-hmm. with like gaslighting these kids into thinking that they had damaged his things and like yeah. getting them to admit to these things that they had never done or didn't know about or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like
plots against them.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Getting them to think that they've been poisoned
and
that they have also poisoned other people.
Yeah. Yeah. And admitting that's to it on camera. One. So much yeah. recording. Mm-hmm. Larry Ray himself had just gotten out of jail when he moved into this house for, I don't even remember what it was. It was like something fraud related, I think.
Yeah. Big fraud guy.
And
master manipulator.
That, yeah. And so he was convinced that he was being watched by like the FBI mm-hmm. and the police and convinced these other people that they were being used by these detectives to get back at him for like whistleblowing on this thing. And I mean, it's just all very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strange. And these people have come out of it. I mean, it's obviously he's been...
For the most part.
Yeah. That's true. For the most part.
There were still 2 women who are struggling deeply.
Mm-hmm. But the people who are no longer like dealing with him have had their own struggles with like contacting their family and yeah. their siblings that were in it and like being reunited. And there's legal battles and things going through the court system still, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So it's just, I don't even know what to say about it. Cause yeah. it's crazy.
It renders you fucking speechless because it's like, how, who, what, how?
Yeah. Yeah, he was total manipulator and just...
They, like, moved him down to North Carolina at one point.
And oh, yeah, it's like work on the farm.
And they were just... He was doing so many drugs that he was up, like, 24 yeah. hours and yeah. would, like, get them up to just dig trenches and stuff. Like, fucking out of control bonker shit.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what I found really interesting was the sister who had fallen in love with him
mm-hmm.
and became his... girlfriend,
common-law wife, yeah, she common says law at one wife. Point.
Mm-hmm. And they, the people who made the documentary, essentially interviewed her almost immediately after his arrest,
mm-hmm.
And then continued interviewing her as she is separating herself from the other woman who is still sort of in it, I guess.
Yeah, who had charges against her.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And sort of going through her own, like, transformation of kind of figuring shit out and what was real. I mean, she talks about, like, I don't know what was real and what wasn't real. And there's these things so ingrained in my mind. And then I think about it and I'm like, was that real or was that something that I made up? And kind of so sort of watching that mm-hmm. being captured, like, was a really, and you don't normally get to see that sort of cycle that they go through after getting out.
And they didn't,
like,
really
this.
Talk to the one woman who was still involved for a long time, who became a sex worker and that whole issue with whether or not she was forced to be a sex worker or not. Like, they didn't really get that whole entire story from her. So
yeah. And I believe this is still, like, working its way through the courts, but it's a very crazy story, horrible, tragic, like, awful, but weird and bizarre. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Bad Vegan, where she, you know, like, the manipulation was kind of strange and very
just complete nonsense,
secretive, but, like, you know, it kind of gave me that sort of vibe of the similar type of manipulation.
It's just so bonkers to me how people can be manipulated into such extreme. Not just manipulated into, like, little tiny stuff.
And these were kids. Yeah. They were college kids. Mm-hmm. Like, these were not, you know, these are people literally in the prime, like, searching for who they are and trying to figure out, like, their place in the world. Like, what a perfect group, because, like, the most impressionable, even at that, like, Jesus Christ.
It's so funny, because I always thought of myself in that, like, age period as, like,
I know.
You don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, I know everything. What has changed? I know what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, except we actually know what we're talking about sometimes. So anyway, I would definitely say it's some heavy shit.
And you're going to be, like, leaving the, like, couple episodes like, what?
Yeah, but it's very, I think it's really worth a watch.
I rewatched it because Did I you? Was like,
there's a lot.
I'm going to have to go back because I don't understand what's going on. Yeah. You know, like, it was just so fucking it's out of control.
Web. Yeah. So that was Stolen Youth, Inside the Cult at Sarah Lawrence on Hulu. Hulu exclusive, I think. So we're going to move right along. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We're talking about some real heavy shit today.
I mean, mine's not at all.
Mine is.
Mine will be, like, the nice ending
to That's good. Yeah. That's good. Because mine is very
I mean, well, okay, there is a death, but
yeah, we're talking about instances of death, kidnapping, rape, sexual assault. I mean, it's like,
so real banger, as they say.
So if you don't want to hear about that, just skip ahead like half an hour, 40 minutes, and listen to Janelle's episode. So I decided that we were going to take a little trip to, honestly, some place that I really enjoy. That is Philadelphia.
Said nobody ever.
Philly, baby. It's because I don't
Home of the cheesesteaks. Home of the craziest fucking sports fans this side of the Mississippi.
It's because I don't live there. You know, exactly. Two of my best friends live out there. So I get to visit and then come back. To the not crazy.
You don't have to live it. Yeah,
it's a good time.
A historical center of the nation's birth.
A historical center of the birth of penitentiaries.
Yeah, that's
one of my favorite places. So we're going to talk about some Philly crime today. Philadelphia,
with
Pennsylvania.
With or without. Oh, God. You're welcome. Oh, God. I may have been to Philadelphia.
That Philly accent is like something else, man. If you've ever seen Mayor of Easttown, which is very good.
I have, yeah.
That accent. That's it. Yep. I was watching that. I was like, oh my God, transported.
Did a pretty good job.
So I am going to talk about Gary Heidnik.
All right.
So Gary Heidnik was born in 1943 and what is probably the first red flag in Eastlake, Ohio.
Goddamn Ohio.
Yeah. Just outside of Cleveland, I believe. His parents divorced at a young age, and Heidrick initially lived with his mom for a few years, but then moved in with his dad and his dad's new wife. He later claimed that he suffered abuse from his father, According to Heidnik, he had a major issue with bedwetting as a child and claimed that it was only exacerbated by his father mocking him and hanging the soiled bed sheets in the window for like the neighborhood to see.
So dumb.
It's worth noting that Heidnik's father denies these allegations.
Of course he does. No one wants to admit being an asshole.
Right. His social life wasn't much better, as Heidnik was viewed as kind of a weird kid. It's reported that he had this oddly shaped head as a result of falling from a tree. That sort of made him a target of ridicule. Heidnik rarely interacted with other students, and he just didn't like make any eye contact with anybody. Now, in 1957, Heidnik joined the Staunton Military Academy in Virginia, and he attended for 2 years before returning to high school, but he never graduated. He actually joined the military before graduating, where he actually started to flourish under the strict structure. The Army continuously gave him excellent marks, but when he applied for like special assignments, he was continuously denied. Eventually, Heidnik transferred to San Antonio, Texas, where he went to train as a medic and then later transferred to the 46th Army Surgical Hospital in Landstuhl, West Germany, where he earned his GED.
This has got some similarities to a man who was killing in the military that we looked at not too long ago.
This has a lot of similarities to a lot of serial killers in general. So by 1962, Heidnik was diagnosed with gastroenteritis, as well as
how unfortunate.
Yeah, right. As well as showing signs of mental illness. So later the same year, Heidnik was transferred to a military hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where he was diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder and honorably discharged from the military.
Okay.
So now he's in Philly.
And he's all kinds of acting crazy.
Right. Yeah. They just dropped him off in Philly. So after his military career, Heidnik enrolled in the University of Pennsylvania, but only attended for one semester. His next venture was working for the VA, but he was fired for attendance and terrible bedside manner. He essentially spent the next 25 years going in and out of psychiatric hospitals, attempting suicide at least 13 times. The rest of his family didn't.
Sounded like he needed help from the VA.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And honestly, like, it definitely seems like mental illness was something that kind of ran in his family. His mom was an alcoholic. She later, like, was diagnosed with bone cancer. And because of the alcoholism, she committed suicide in 1970 by drinking mercuric acid.
Oh God.
Heidnik's brother Terry spent some time in mental institutions as well, and he like attempted suicide on several times. So like, definitely seems like the family as a whole really needed help.
Yeah.
Heidnik started his next career as a church leader.
That is a 180.
In 1971, at 28 years old, Heidnik formed the United Church of the Ministers of God.
Word salad.
Initially beginning with 5 members and $1,500, the church would eventually grow to around 1,550 members with $500,000 in the bank by 1986. And I believe in 2020 dollars, that's like $2 million. In 2020. Okay. Yeah. In 1976, he has this church, by the way. It's still just like hanging around. I think it's still active. It's it's not, I don't necessarily think it was like a cult or anything. I think it was just like a
church.
Church. Yeah. In 1976 is when Heidnik began his criminal career, when he was charged with aggravated assault and carrying a weapon without a license after firing a gun at one of his tenants. Grazed his cheek.
Okay.
He was also like dating around at this time, and he seemed to pick up girlfriends from these various mental institutions that he worked at.
Okay.
So he had a child with his first girlfriend, Gail Linkow, However, the child was eventually put into foster care because of the mental capacity of the child's mother. Hynek would have another child with another girlfriend, Anjanette Davidson, who he met while he was at an institution. The child was also given to foster care as well due to his mother's mental capacity. Mm-hmm. Anjanette's sister was also in the same institution. Her name was Alberta Davidson. So Hynek had his next run-in with the law in 1978 when he signed out Alberta on a day pass, mm-hmm. took her to his home where he imprisoned her in the basement.
Okay.
She was later found by authorities and returned to the hospital where, upon examination, it was discovered that she had been raped, sodomized, and contracted gonorrhea. Hynek was arrested.
Well, good.
And charged with kidnapping, rape, unlawful restraint, false imprisonment, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and interfering with the custody of a committed person. And for all of that, and after some appeals, he did have his original sentence overturned. Mm-hmm. He ended up serving about 3 years in mental institutions before being released in 1983. How are we feeling about this so far?
I feel like there's too much releasing happening going on here.
Again, I mean, they put him in like mental institutions, but it doesn't really sound like not for long enough.
Yeah.
Shortly after being released from custody, Hynek began communicating with Betty Disto, who is a woman that he met through a matrimonial service in the Philippines.
Okay, we're going there. Okay.
Yes, yep. So they communicated back and forth for 2 years, and then Disto traveled to the U.S. to marry Hynek, but the marriage did not last long, like at all, because Hynek is a terrible person. Pretty much.
Yeah, I'd say so.
It was reported that he would force Disto to watch while he had sex with other women, sometimes forcing her to get involved. Disto, luckily, was able to find help within the Filipino community. Mm-hmm. And they, like, helped her escape, essentially, from his house. And then she almost immediately went to the police and told them that he had raped her and forced her into all of these, you know, sexual assault situations, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Hynek was charged with assault, indecent assault, spousal rape, and involuntary deviant sexual intercourse for that. Now, later in 1986, on Thanksgiving, Hynek picked up 25-year-old Josefina Rivera, who was working on the streets. The two had stopped at McDonald's before Hynek drove the pair back to his house on North Marshall Street. When they arrived, Rivera noticed that he had this, like, weird lock on his door.
Okay.
And he had pulled out his keys, and he only had half a key. So what he had done is he had split the key in half and left the other half in the lock to his door, mm-hmm. so that the only people that could get in was somebody who had the other half of the key, which was he had the only other half of that key.
Or a locksmith. Who has all the tools to take that apart. But yeah. Not that smart, are you?
Yeah. So the two went upstairs and had sex in Hynek's bedroom. And then when they were finished, Rivera was getting dressed and getting ready to leave, and Hynek attacked the woman and then put her into a pit that he had dug in his basement.
Okay, that's not great for the structure of your home, first of all, sir. Yeah,
the pit was then boarded up with just, like, left little bits of light, like, coming through the boards of the
what
pit.
Year was this?
So this was in 1986.
Okay, so before Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, so that is partially based off of
okay.
this gentleman.
You said that, and I was like, hold on. Yes.
Just over 24 hours later, Hynek kidnapped 25-year-old Sandra Lindsay from the Elwin Institute, taking her home and putting her into the pit with Rivera. Later, he forced Lindsay to write a letter to her mother saying that she had left the institute voluntarily. Mm. But her mother was, like, pretty skeptical and reported her missing to the police immediately. And she even gave them Hynek's address, but they were kind of like, this is just like a runaway. She had gotten shortly after a Christmas card with, like, $5 in it from, you know, quote unquote, from Lindsay. And so the police were like, she just ran away. It's fine. You know, 80s shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While Rivera and Lindsay were being held captive, Heidnik repeatedly raped and tortured and starved both women. I'm not going to go into heavy detail because it's just a fucking lot, but it was not a good situation. Just under a month later, on December 22nd, Heidnik found 17-year-old Lisa Thomas walking along the side alongside the road to a friend's house. Thinking she was a sex worker, he tried to pick her up, but she wasn't. She was not, and got like offended. And so he was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, let me give you a ride to wherever you're going. So he gave her a ride to this friend's house, waited for her to come out, and somehow talked her into going to dinner. They later went back to Heidnik's house, where he gave Thomas a drugged glass of wine. While she was unconscious, he raped her before putting her into the pit with the other two women. So around this time, Heidnik appointed Rivera a sort of like boss of the other women. She had been in captivity the longest and eventually began working with Heidnik to like watch over the women and convince him that like, I'm on your side, like, to get better treatment. She was also forced to help him in torturing some of these other women. It was definitely like a very Stockholm type situation, it seemed to me, where she was just trying to like survive. So she kind of is put in charge of like reporting on what the other women are doing while Heidnik is not there, essentially. Just 2 weeks later, Heidnik kidnapped 19-year-old Deborah Dudley and forced her into the pit with the others. On January 18th, 1987, Heidnik abducted 18-year-old Jacqueline Askins, placing her in the pit. Then on by February 1987, Sandra Lindsay passed away, mainly from starvation. He had been withholding food from her, and when he went to feed her again, she was dead. So Heidnik hauled her body upstairs, where it was dismembered, and then allegedly some of it was cooked and ground and mixed into dog meat that was later fed to the other women downstairs. The only reason I include that is because there's some speculation as to whether that actually happened or if that is details that Heidnik included later when he was trying to plead insanity. So there is some question as to whether that happened or whether he told the women that happened at the time to make them believe that they were like, you know, to mess with them psychologically, or if, he just embellished for like his insanity defense. Heidnik continued his torture and abuse. He eventually killed Deborah Dudley as well after he poured water into the pit and then ran electricity to the shackles that they were wearing, and she was electrocuted to death. He had forced Rivera to help him on this occasion, so she was not actually down there with the rest of the women. He then took Dudley's body and hid it in the, or disposed of it in the New Jersey Pine Barrens.
Big place where the mafia would drop people off to. And supposedly where there's a cryptid.
That's more what I know it for, is a cryptid. Rivera had worked really hard to convince Heidnik that she was working with him at this point. And he was letting her into the house a little bit more. And occasionally she was even accompanying him on like trips out of the house. But on March 24th, 1987, Heidnik took Rivera and drove around Philadelphia, where they found 24-year-old Agnes Adams. The two kidnapped the woman, forcing her into the pit as well. But later that night, somehow, Rivera managed to talk Heidnik into letting her go to visit her family just for like a short time, like a couple of minutes. He agreed and drove her to a nearby gas station that was like kind of by her boyfriend's house. And she had children too. So it was kind of by her boyfriend's house. And he was like, I'm going to wait at this gas station. You go for a couple of minutes and then come back and I'll wait here for you. As soon as she was out of sight, she went to the nearest payphone and called 911. And the police showed up, heard her story, like saw the shackle marks and stuff on her arms and legs, and went to the gas station and arrested Heidnik immediately. When they arrived at his house, police discovered the women being kept in his basement along with Sandra Lindsay's forearm in the freezer and other evidence of the dismemberment. Mm-hmm. Police also arrested a man named Cyril Brown, who claimed to be Heidnik's best friend. He received a $50,000 bail and agreed to testify against Heidnik, admitting that he was witness to both Lindsay's death and dismemberment. So there was this like friend of his just like hanging out.
Yeah. If I walked in and you were like taking apart someone, I'd be like, this is where I slowly back up and leave.
So when Heidnik finally made it to court, he said the women were already in the house like when I moved in.
Even if that was true, yeah. You had the opportunity to let them go.
Yeah. And they were in the house for 4 months, like total. He had these women trapped in his basement. He was just like, they were just there when I moved in, which is also really fucked up that you would not say anything. Like what? Again, unless it was like something he said to aid his insanity defense. Mm-hmm. But like... So anyway, they definitely tried to prove, his attorneys tried to prove that Heidnik was insane, legally insane. But remember that religion he started?
Yeah, vaguely. That church he started?
So he opened accounts under the name of his church with like Merrill Lynch.
Okay.
And the attorneys, the prosecuting attorneys, basically said that the fact that he was able to accumulate around $550,000 in a brokerage account and like invest it was enough to prove that he was a smart investor that knew what the fuck he was doing.
Yeah, that means you're not insane. Yeah.
And they even had a guy from Merrill Lynch like testify
before. I have no idea what you just said. Yeah. You know? So maybe I'm insane.
Yeah. They had a guy from Merrill Lynch testify like, like he came in and was talking to me about investments and like was totally competent. So like I wouldn't have any impression that he's insane at all.
Yeah. But then there's also that argument to play the stock market and to do finances. You have to be crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So, yeah, they basically said, no, that's not going to fly. And on July 1st, 1988, Heidnik was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 6 counts of kidnapping, 5 counts of rape, 4 counts of aggravated assault, and 2 counts of involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and sentenced to death. In 1997, Heidnik's daughter and ex-wife attempted to get a stay.
Separate people.
Yes. Yeah. Two separate people.
Because it could, his daughter for him, and it could also be one his person.
Ex-wife. Yeah. Yeah. And this was the, I believe the second child that he had with the woman who was institutionalized. So her and her daughter attempted to get a stay of execution due to mental incompetence. But after 2 years of litigation, it was denied. And on July 6th, 1999, Heidrich was executed by lethal injection in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. And he was actually the, as of last year, the last person to be executed in the state of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
So.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think they still have the death penalty, or they're working to get it overturned. So they haven't had any death, especially with the, I guess that's just the Philadelphia DA. Anyway, Krasner is the best. But that is the story of Gary Heidnik.
Well, then.
It's a lot. At least it's short, so it didn't have torture for too long.
Unlike those women.
That was a poor choice of word. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Y'all. Listen. It's my nap time.
You need sensitivity training, Vicky. Just kidding.
Oh, my God.
So we're going to go back to the glamour days of Philadelphia, which I know is hard to imagine Philadelphia as being glamorous. Yeah. But I want you to remember that it is the first stop from New York to Chicago on the Mafia train. So you have New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Chicago. Those are the hot spots. So, yes, Philadelphia was glamorous in the height of the mafia era, which is where we're going to be hitting a little bit.
Okay.
There is a lot of mafia action in Philly. It's mafia adjacent, obviously. But we're going to talk about like the late 50s, early 60s. This is about a dame and a henchman and the most famous burglary in Pennsylvania history. The Pottsville burglary.
Oh my gosh. This is right up your alley. It is. Girl,
especially if
monsters.
You look at the photos that were taken. So I used a book called, oh gosh, what's it called? True Crime Philadelphia. And it had some great stuff in there. And then also, where did I look this up? Temple University's Digital Library.
Oh my gosh.
Also,
the Fringe.
Also had amazing photographs.
Okay.
So.
Wait, did you say Temple?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm, I know. As someone who works at a university, I have access to a lot of other university libraries. So.
I don't know when this episode is going to come out and if the strike is going to be resolved by then, but I just want to say that as a podcast, mm-hmm. we stand with the Temple TAs.
Yes, I stand with all TAs,
yeah.
as I have been a TA.
I'm just saying. If we're going to take a stand on something, mm-hmm. it might as well be this.
Also, the SAIC adjuncts who are also picketing yeah. for, like, fair wages and health insurance, you know.
Anyway.
Not a political podcast. Got to bring that back around. Now, this story starts in Philly. It's going to take a swerve to Pottsville, and then it's going to come back around again. So...
Okay,
we're Pottsville. Gonna be all over into the
Pottsville,
you know,
is such
it's a
an old
suburb,
tiny,
okay,
like, town name.
Yeah. So we're starting with the temptress of the whole story, whose name is Lillian Reyes. And Lillian Reyes was considered a bombshell of her time period. Very Ava Gardner, very
is this the woman in the
Vivian
Fringe?
Lee. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She started dancing as a chorus girl in her teens in the late 40s and 50s. And if you're not familiar, a chorus girl was a really highly sought after job as it was really, really glamorous. It was movie star adjacent. You would have many people coming in and out to watch these shows. It was the main form of entertainment, even more so than movies.
That sounds fun.
And you could meet many a rich man dancing and singing in a theater.
Oh, yeah.
And she did. She met many a rich man and she had many a sugar daddies.
Well,
girl,
wow.
She would be showered with gifts, jewelry, and just straight up literal piles of cash. Okay. And you made good money as a chorus girl, especially if you were in one of the higher end productions.
Yeah.
It's estimated that in her time as a chorus girl, she was given $1.3 million in today's money.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Damn.
That was money and jewelry.
Damn.
Yes. In 1959, the 29-year-old former chorus girl was juggling a few boyfriends, just enjoying her life, not working, being super glamorous.
Get it.
It's like my dream. like a stay-at-home wiener dog mom with a little bit of like chorus girl accents, you know.
Stay-at-home wiener dog mom.
Yeah. Aspirations.
Nice. Yes. Listen, just manifest it.
Right.
The universe will provide.
I need like three more wiener dogs to make that happen. So she was dating a few older gentlemen at this time. And one gentleman included the 53-year-old Clyde Bing Miller.
Okay.
Oh, Bingy.
He
was an engineer. He was lovesick with this woman and wanted to give her like literally all of his money. Like, not even kidding, to his detriment, was giving her so much money.
Oh, my God.
He paid for her apartment. He paid for a maid to take care of her apartment. He gave her multiple mink coats.
Okay.
He gave her
sugar zadze.
Everything.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, you're my number one love. And he had a family, okay?
I feel like this was not uncommon.
Not at all.
Especially if you got the money to just be like, shower it with gifts, gifts,
exactly.
Gifts. Yeah.
Now, her full-time lover, however, was named Ralph Jr. Staino.
Was he okay with all this?
And he was a Philly mobster.
Oh, gosh.
So he was very okay with this. He was 2 years younger than her. So he worked with the K&A gang and the Scarfo outfit, but primarily he was the lowest level just kind of bum in these organizations, you know, just a street guy. He was a stocky boxer type, and he loved Rays and loved, like, truly loved her. Like, this is the true mobster dame 1960s movie star relationship.
That's adorable.
Yes. And he could never really fully give as much to her as he wanted to. He wanted her to have no sugar daddies. He wanted to be the one to be able to give her all the money, but he just couldn't, being in the lowest part of the organization.
Yeah.
Now, his two buds, Vincent Blaney and Robert Poulsen, were part of the K&A gang, and they often were rolling people over and burglarizing them, and Stana would occasionally assist with these endeavors. So he was kind of just, like, helping out, doing a few things here and there, beating people up for money, you know.
You know.
Yeah. He wasn't a bad-looking dude.
Yeah.
I'd be like, okay. You're a mobster? Okay. Now, Clyde Miller, Ray's sugar daddy number one, worked with a guy on occasion named John Rich. Now, John Rich was the owner of a strip mining company. In fact, the largest strip mining company in all of Pennsylvania.
Ooh.
His last name was super fitting, too, because he was also the richest dude in Pennsylvania at the time. Now, according to the book True Crime Philadelphia, Clyde Miller told Ray's about Rich's money that he had hid in his home. Now, this book is, I don't know if it's 100%, I wouldn't say accurate. I don't know if it's 100% true to the story because it takes from a bunch of people who are involved, who are all just finger pointing at each other.
Sure, sure.
Take the quotes with a grain of salt, okay? What I'm trying to say. He stated that Rich only let the government know about half the money he was making and he hid the rest in his home. This will be a point of contention later.
Okay.
Rich was on vacation with his wife in Europe in August of 1959 when someone or someones broke into his home in Pottsville after 8 p.m. $478,000 in U.S. currency and $17,000 worth of jewelry were taken from a safe, which had been peeled by the burglars. Now, if you're not familiar with that and you don't watch enough mafia like, this is my last job heist movie, that means that they take a safe and chip away one of the edges and peel back the steel and open the rest of it like a banana.
Okay. So it's exactly what it sounds like.
Yep.
Okay.
On the afternoon of August 8th, 1959, the caretaker entered the house and found that someone had broken in and forced open the door of the safe. So they came in early hours in the morning, left, took their shit, and the caretaker came in and was like, holy shit. They had broken in through the kitchen back door, which is the main door that the caretaker would come through.
Okay.
The caretaker informed the son of John B. Rich, who then also called the police. When the investigation was made, it was discovered that two pillowcases upstairs had been removed from the main bed, and Mr. Rich's wife's jewels had been taken. It was also later discovered that they took paperwork, which wound up being stocks and bonds and things.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the fucking weird part, okay? The two were on vacation in Europe. This happened on August 8th. They were notified, and they didn't come back until after Labor Day. That's September, y'all. That's a full month.
Okay.
Now, the son reported it to the police. They came and did the initial investigation, but didn't move on it until the couple returned from Europe.
Why?
Now, here's the other issue. He said that he was missing only $17,000 in cash and $3,500 in banknotes, and then the whatever quantity it was for the jewelry, $17,000 in jewelry. So together, that made what, $34,000 in assets and $3,500 in banknotes.
And
in the reality, $478,000 were taken.
So he was saying less was taken than what was actually there. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, shortly after this robbery, William Ray's bought a nightclub called the Celebrity Room and opened it with a lavish, roaring 1920s party complete with flappers and champagne fountains, which is the picture you were talking about, the girl in the French.
Mm-hmm.
She claimed that she had saved tons of money from all of her sugar daddies and her chorus girl checks to purchase the nightclub. That's what she was working towards. So she bought the club. She was the owner, and she was having amazing shows and raking in a lot of cash.
Nice.
Now, in January of 1960, Richard Francis Blaney, who was a brother of Vincent Blaney, who was Ralph Steno's best friend,
okay,
if we recall from the beginning. Lots of names here.
Yes.
He was infatuated with Captain Ferguson of the Philadelphia Detective Bureau.
Okay.
He wanted desperately to be a G-man, but he was just, you know, a street guy who did some crimes, but was like, you know, it'd be really cool to be a G-man.
Yeah.
So much so he was obsessed with this guy that he sold his own brother out to get out of a small arrest issue.
Oh, damn.
He told Ferguson that his brother and two accomplices were the ones who robbed Rich's house with a tip from a woman.
Okay.
So the police attempted to set up a sting to get all of these people.
Okay.
Now, Robert Poulsen was one of the first. He was one of the burglars with, supposedly, the guys that night. He was arrested and on April 3rd, 1960, gave a complete statement to the police in which he implicated the two appellants in the case. This is from a jury site.
Okay.
That it was weird. he gave complete details of the crime, allegedly.
So he was saying, no, it wasn't me, it was the other guys.
No, he was saying he was there with the other guys.
Oh.
He also stated that Lillian Reyes and her sugar daddy were the ones who started the whole thing by conversing about it.
Okay.
Now, according to Poulsen, this is how the night went, and this is from the True Crime Philadelphia book. 8 p.m., they pulled up to the home and sat on the street waiting to see if there was anyone coming or going. After some time, they entered the home through the kitchen. Upon entering, they went into the basement where the safe was and took action peeling back the sides. The safe was so stuffed with cash that they had a hard time getting it out.
Okay.
They had to take two pillowcases from upstairs to carry all the money in addition to the bags that they brought. While upstairs, they also stole bonds and jewelry from the dresser. They then left the home and went to a strip club for a bit.
That's wild.
Right? Where they did brag to strippers about how much money they had. They didn't say where they got it, but they did brag to the strippers. The men immediately started spending the cash. Now,
well then,
when the trial started, this person, Robert Poulsen, recanted his confession. So just keep that in mind. He said that everything that he said was not true. Rich Blaney became a star witness as he was the first to tip off the police. And then Poulsen also originally was a star witness when then he recanted. So they were deciding not to put him on the stand anymore.
Smart.
But the Blaneys became a target because they were associated with the Philadelphia mob. He was effectively a rat.
Yeah.
He was ratting out other mobsters.
Not a good situation.
Rich Blaney became very, very paranoid about being killed. And unfortunately, he had a lot of reasons to be scared. So,
oh boy.
If you have the document open, you can take a look at the next photo. In 1960, Poulsen was shot but survived. 6 months later, in 1961, Vincent Blaney was murdered. And then in July of 1961, on Rich Blaney's birthday, he went to get into his two-tone sedan dressed up to celebrate his birthday. He went to start the car for a family trip when it exploded.
Yeah, it definitely...
It exploded.
I was looking at this picture trying to figure out what it was.
It looks a little bit like a car accident, but then when you look harder...
Well, it almost looks like a plane crash.
Yeah.
But so, no, that thing is not a car.
Mm-hmm. Three sticks of dynamite packed into the car, forcing an explosion upward into
the
sky.
That's so much dynamite.
Which was actually a really good thing that they did it that way, because if it would have exploded outward, how close the street is and how close the houses are... Other people would have died.
Oh, true.
His wife, Joni, was inside with their 9-month-old son, and they were getting ready to go on a trip when the car exploded, and it caused all of the windows in their home to break.
Oh, my God. That were facing the street. Jeez.
Now, a man named John Berkery was arrested for the attempted murder of Poulsen and the two murders of the Blaney brothers. He was an associate of Ralph Steno, the K&A gang, the Scarfo crime family.
Yeah.
But it's not exactly known who ordered him to attempt to kill Poulsen the Blaney brothers.
Dude, mob shit is so
Steno
shady.
Was never a, no one tried to kill him, allegedly. We don't know. But he was fine. He never, no one tried to shoot him or blow up his shit. But also John Berkery was arrested before his case came to trial. So who knows he would have been murdered.
Right.
Now, Ralph Steno Jr. was obviously arrested and tried. And it was a little, so this is where things get a little weird. So he was tried for burglary and larceny. He was questioned for 3 days. Okay. He was repeatedly like bullied and they were trying to get a confession out of him. Now, he kept saying he had no idea what they were talking about. He doesn't know what they were talking about. The police then read to him the confession from Poulsen and he didn't even react. Then they took him to Pottsville and made him stand outside of the home that was burglarized, allegedly, oh, by him. And again, he said nothing. They stood him in the street and they were like yelling at him, like being belligerent.
Oh my.
So he went to trial purely based off of eyewitness accounts, supposedly, of him being in areas, and then the confession of Poulsen. Now, this gentleman named Alfred Ronconi testified that he knew Ralph Steno well and that in January or February of 1960, Steno came to his place of business with a sum of money contained in a shirt box. Steno asked Ronconi to take the money to the bank and have it changed into $100 bills. That, in accordance with the request, he took the money to a teller to the bank with whom he was like acquainted with. So he knew this person personally. And there they exchanged the money for $100 bills and the amount of that wound up being $10,000. There was more money in a separate box, the amount unknown, but the teller refused to change more than the $10,000.
Okay.
Because then that would require a signature of the owner of the money.
Yeah.
So he returned the $10,000 in $100 bills, and then the unexchanged money he left in the box and gave back to Steno. They also called the banker who testified, yes, I exchanged this money.
Interesting. I like that, like, yeah, I'll step over the line, but not too much.
Yeah.
Not to, I don't want to break any bank rules.
Yeah, because then that person would have to show up flagged, and sign, yeah. And then, you know, obviously the money wasn't tracked because that guy said that he didn't have it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
True.
And also, if he alone had $10,000 and they split everything evenly, obviously there's more than $34,000.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, math. Now, Lillian Rees also went to trial as a co-conspirator in the entire thing. And during her trial, the purchase of the nightclub came up. And her friends testified saying that she was an avid saver and one woman who lived with her said that she had $30,000 in cash under her bed in a shoebox. So
okay.
One of her other friends that she worked with as a chorus girl before she bought the club also said that men would throw money at her literally.
Yeah.
Like give her stacks of cash. Right? Like, oh, you're so beautiful. Yeah. Here's hundreds. Throw it at your face. Now, the jury in the Lillian Rees trial ended in a hung jury in 1961. The prosecutors would take 2 years, but they would get back to court in 1963 to try her again.
Okay.
They would not quit her. They could not quit her. In 1963, Lillian Rees was arrested in a sting operation while they were getting her second trial up. An undercover police officer gave her fake money at the club that she was at and said to her that it was fake, and she accepted the cash. This was a bit of a precarious situation, and I was
that doesn't sound like it actually happened.
Right? That sounds fake.
Yeah.
But she was arrested, and her club and home were searched. They didn't find anything. But they were trying to, like, get her in many different ways to show that she was a criminal. So mm-hmm. when they were going into the second trial, they could say, well, she was arrested after the fact for all of these things.
Yeah.
It didn't go.
Yeah.
But they tried.
Yeah.
So she was, you know, she did the second trial and ultimately was convicted, as was Steno. In 1969, so they went to jail. In 1969, one of the confessions was thrown out during an appeals process, and that caused a chain of events. So after copious amounts of appeals, so from 1963 to 1969, appeals, they were finally, like, their convictions were overturned in 1970.
Okay.
Because that confession was thrown out and there was no other evidence against them.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, they couldn't track the cash. They never actually found any money or anything.
Do you think she had anything to do with it?
I don't know if they actually stole from him.
Yeah.
So, I'll give you my theory at the end. There was a lot of conflicting information regarding these trials, and it was very, very hard to wade through the opinions and the facts.
Yeah.
Because this is like peak, like, people talking shit era. Right, I'm a mobster. Yeah.
And a lot of those, like, overblown headlines and sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So, altogether, the three trials amongst them, because she had two trials, he had one, took 10 years and cost the state $50,000.
Oh, my God.
Now, after...
Hope it was worth it.
Right? After Lillian Reyes and Ralph Steno were released from jail, they got married.
Oh.
And they moved to Florida.
Oh. I know. Love that for them. Yes.
The pair would stay together for 54 years.
Oh, my God. That's adorable.
Like, I want to cry. It's so cute. Now, the unfortunate part was Ralph Steno would go to jail on a racketeering charge related to the Scarfo gang, and he was in jail for 21 years.
Oh,
but they stayed together.
That's adorable.
Though. When he was released, he went back to Florida to live with Lillian Reyes, and she died in 2009 at age 79, and he died in 2015.
Oh.
Now, here's my thoughts and feelings on this. Okay. So there was actually the guy, Mr. Rich, do you remember him?
Yeah.
He was actually convicted on some tax evasion charges of about a decade after the...
He was the one who was on vacation when this was stolen.
Yes.
Okay.
So here's my thoughts and opinions. I think he set up his home to be burglarized.
Okay.
To get out of having to claim the money that he had.
Yeah.
Because people were already on him about tax evasion.
Oh.
And I think he hired someone related to the Philadelphia mob. And I think it might have been those guys that were murdered.
Yeah.
I don't know if Ralph Steno was involved. And I don't necessarily know if Lillian Reyes was involved either. But I think that that guy who was her sugar daddy went to her and asked her if she knew anybody who would do this.
Yeah.
And she said yes. And she probably asked her boyfriend, who then asked the K&A gang guys.
Yeah.
If they would do a fake heist, basically. Steal the money from his home.
Yeah.
And then return it back and get to keep some.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I think happened.
I definitely get, like, a vibe, like, something is not right with all of it. Like, something is kind of amiss. And even when you had initially talked about him being overseas and being gone when all of this was happening, I was
not
immediately
saying,
like,
anything when he came back a month later.
That's
why I think he was in on it.
I immediately was like, yeah, this sounds like almost like insurance fraud, right? Or something.
Yes.
It was like like a setup.
And when you get bonds and stocks stolen and you have insurance on them, you get more money.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then the jewelry has insurance on it.
Yeah.
Which you always claim more than it's worth.
Right.
So he was going to make money from this, hide money.
Yeah.
And then throw a couple $1,000 to some schmucks to fucking steal some stuff.
Yeah. That seems more most probable.
What I think happened is Ralph Steno, Lillian Reyes, and Bing Miller were the ones who set up this fake sting. That's my phone. Sorry. Who set up this fake sting, had his buddies do it. And then they were going to start talking shit so that they wouldn't go to jail. And then the Philly mob was like, shut it down.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about rich guys, most of them have some sort of affiliations with the mafia.
Right.
Or crime, organized crime.
Interesting.
But that is the Pottsville burglary, the most famous burglary in all of Pennsylvania. And there are some amazing pictures of, like, Lillian Reyes and Ralph Steno getting married. There's these beautiful glamour shots of her. There's pictures of her opening her club. Like, the True Crime Philadelphia book is really good.
Yeah.
That's just one story in it.
That's
There's
cool.
lots of other stories. So
That's cool.
check it out.
Nice. Well, before you... I don't know.
Commit a heist.
Commit a heist. Maybe check out this podcast.
We're the Vocal Fries. I'm Carrie.
And I'm Megan.
And we have a podcast about linguistic discrimination.
We talk about language, not being a jerk, not judging people for the way that they speak, and we try to have a good time.
We talk about things like vocal fry, swearing, Southern American English, and prescriptive grammar.
You can find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
All right, guys, that has been our episode. What do we got, Janelle, coming up?
We will have a live show coming up at the end of this year in November in Rockford with Haunted Rockford. The details are still being hammered out, but we will be doing another live show with a bunch of cool spooky people as well. So
be a good time.
Yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that.
Appealed.
Yes.
Maybe. Cool. That sounds fun. Thanks, Janelle.
Yeah.
On that note, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zaszewski, the Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
See you later, kids.
Kids.
It's my good, it's my mafia voice.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form or another.
If I knew how to do a Philly accent, I would, but I can't even. I will butcher.
Yeah. All I know is like, weird... if you say whiz, I say feel like that is water.
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 Wooter.
That's close.
It's a wooter.
Yeah.
They call it wooter ice. I've never understood
We want to publicly apologize to the entire city of Philadelphia and even the state of Pennsylvania.
Why would I?
For the horrible accents that we were unable to do.
Oh my God.